Shalom. Thank you for listening to this week's message from Emmaus Road Fellowship, where we encounter Yeshua in the scriptures. Check out our website at walkingemmausroad.org, where you'll find additional teachings and information on visiting us in Kingwood, Texas. If you've been blessed by this ministry, please consider giving to support Emmaus Road's mission of spreading the good news of the kingdom. May God grant you shalom in the name of Yeshua, our Messiah.
All right. So obviously I'm not Chris, so if you're new to here, new to us at Emmaus, I'm Omid. I used to have long hair wrapped in a bun, bigger beard, kind of, not like Richard's beard, but I was going there. But yeah, so we took all that off. So it might look like a new face, but I am, Chris was out, so I'm stepping in for him. Although they did come back today just to see me, so great. No pressure, right? No pressure. So, okay. Well, today's portion, we have, I'm hearing a lot of echo. Do y'all hear echo here? No? It's good? Okay. All right. Okay. All right. So today's portion is Shelach. So if I had to title it, I'm going to give it the title, Walk by Faith. Shelach means to send. So here we have what's going on is God is telling Moses to send out some men on your behalf to go scout out the land. All right, so it's interesting right now I'm getting Shelach because, you know, this is random, right? It's random. We're also going through the study of Acts in our house. And so we're leading this study, which is also to send out. The sent ones is what it's called in FFOZ. So the Shelachim, the Shaliachs, right? And so it's just interesting. So we have this parallel with this story, obviously, that Moses is sending 12 spies out into the land. And we have Yeshua, who has sent his 12 emissaries out into the land, is our New Testament portion for today, our Brit Hadashah portion. The overview of what's going on today is just, I'm going to give kind of like paint a broad picture, and then we'll hone down on one. But where 10 spies go into the land, they bring back a bad report. There's grumbling in the camp. Then judgment is upon them because of this this word that they've brought back. God says, now you are doomed to wander the rest of this desert for the next 40 years until this generation dies off and your children will be the one who inherit the land. When they get in the land, portion goes over sacrifices that they are to bring upon getting in. There's a section about tzitzit at the end. And there is, of course, the one law for Jew and Gentile. I will leave that for Chris to go over. So, bummer, I'm not going to talk about the one law. All right, so I'm going to talk about the 10 spies, though. All right, so this portion, Shelach, it's actually said in the Hebrew, Shelach Lecha. So what does that sound like? That harkens back to this portion of Abram in his story, Lech Lecha. All right, so this was when Abram, God tells him, get up. Right, get up for yourself from your country. Go to the land that I, from your country, from your father's house here, it says up here, and I will show you and I will make you part of a great nation, bless you, and those who bless you, I'll bless, and those who curse you, I will curse. Right, so he's giving Abraham this promise. He makes the land covenant promise to Abraham. The land of Canaan is the one that he is giving to them because of the abominations that's performed through all of the people that are living in the land now. God is kicking them out. He promises to give the land to his seed, to Abram's seed. And Abram trusts God and is counted to him for righteousness. He believes in God. So it says that he believes. So some say faith, this aspect here. So what is faith? Is it just a belief? Is it something abstract? Is it something that, you know, we've heard also faith is action, something in action? Right, so Hebrews 11:1 says, now faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. The TLV version says, for the evidence of realities not seen. I really like that. It kind of underpins this kind of this energy I see like this. So I put on here like physics. I'm looking at physics and I'm looking at potential and kinetic energy. The potential energy is a stored energy. It's just waiting to be unleashed. I see this faith is kind of like this. This kinetic energy is an energy that's a motion, that's an action. Right? Can we look at faith and trust in this way. And James 2:1-2 says, "But some will say, 'I have faith, and you have faith, and I have works. Show me your faith without works, and I will show you faith by my works.' You believe that God is one. You do well. The demons also believe and shudder. But do you want to know, you empty person, that faith without works is dead? Wasn't Abraham our father proved righteous by works when he offered up Isaac, his son, on the altar? So you see that faith worked together with his works, and by the works his faith was made complete." Belief and trust, like I was saying, this idea of this conceptual potential type energy. But yeah, we live in a world of action. We live in a world that we have to do, right? So that belief is not acted upon. Until it's acted upon, it remains incomplete, just like James is saying here. Have you ever received a word from the Lord, whether it's prophetic or not, and you trust that, and you believe that, and he's given that to you, and you say, this is directly from Hashem. I know this is him. This is the faith that you have in him. But then you walk that out, right? You continue to walk that, what you heard from him, because you know the one who gave it to you is faithful and true to deliver on his promises. And one day you will see that promise realized. Like dreams and visions, I would go to like families who have, they have certain values that they want to promote in their home. Businesses who have certain missions that they want to go for. They have these goals and visions. So they're making these plans and goals that move them closer and closer to these dreams. And along the way, they're course correcting because they know that the goal is where they want to be. So they're always fixed on that goal. And throughout your journeys, things are going to be knocking you off path, testing you to see how resolute are you in this faith, in this belief and trust that you have. There's faith and trust, and then there's the experience of that faith, which when that manifests in your life, no one can take that from you. It solidifies your trust because now you've experienced it on your own. You know that what God has said, he has accomplished in my life. I remember there was a story about when Rachel, one time, so she was going home late one night. This was back in our college days. She was driving home one night, and we were very much into, you know, big youth groups back then, church still, you know, throughout college. So we have this belief, right? Experience God here and there. Sometimes it seems like he's not there. We experience him here and there. She's on her way home, and I get a call. I get a call at like 2 in the morning. And it's from her. She says, she was frantic. She's like, "You got to come here." She's like, "I just got in a car accident." I rush over there. So she fell asleep on this road. Now the road is winding type road. It goes into it curves, and right at the curve is a ditch that has two trees. And then from the two trees at the end of that ditch is a concrete culvert. Her car is unscathed. They said that when she went through, her car went sideways through the trees and then came and landed in that ditch. There was a guy who lived in a home where his house was right in front of this ditch. He had just laid a ton of dirt right in front of that concrete culvert area in that ditch. And all of that dirt stopped her from hitting that concrete culvert. It was like, don't tell me, you know, God is not active. That is a miracle. That was a miracle. You know, God, he tells Abram, he says, "I'm giving you a land. Just get up and go." And he does. He just goes. He trusts in God. Abram walks the land. He sees the Canaanites living there. Surely he must have seen the giants, right? He's moving around. It says the Canaanites live there. It says that he went to Hebron, which is also known as Kiryat Arba. Arba was the name of the father of Anak, who's the Anakim, who are the giants. So you can see, through this whole time, he sees all this, and he's not, you don't hear him wavering in his belief in God. The parallels of to his seed coming out, right? It goes to the land. There's a famine in the land. There's a famine in the land with Jacob. They go to Egypt and his whole family. They travel to Egypt. Abram goes to Egypt. Pharaoh takes his wife. Jacob, all of Jacob's children is taken by Pharaoh, and they are then put into enslavement. Plagues come upon Pharaoh's house. Abram has, and he says, you need to leave with your wife. Plagues, of course, we know the 10 plagues coming out of Egypt. They're kicked out and told to leave. They both go journeying through the desert. As Abram comes back to Hebron, what happens is Sarah dies. Right? Sarah, Abraham goes and purchases this field for her to bury her. Can we look at this like a first fruits down payment that Abraham is purchasing a portion of the land? Right? He purchased it from the Hittite with the promise of the rest that's going to come. Her death secured the ability to obtain a portion of the land in a very much a legal transaction. We have the death of the one who delivered, who's delivered the promised seed, Isaac, right? Who has many Yeshua parallels to pave the way for the entry into this land. So let's go back to Shalak. And quickly back to the previous portion. Moses gathered the 70 and he rests the spirit on them. And they start prophesying. Right? Eldad and Medad is prophesying in the camp. Joshua here says, my Lord, stop them. Moses says to him. Right? They say, that's not the one I want to go to. It's already there. Okay. Moses said, are you jealous for my sake? I wish that God would place a spirit on everyone. It's an interesting thing for Moses to say. Right? Are you jealous for my sake? Rashi states that what were Eldad and Medad prophesying? They were prophesying that Moses will die and Joshua will be the one to lead them into the promised land. Is that why Moses is saying, are you zealous on my behalf? Are you trying to defend me and my honor? From here we can go and look at now we go back to Shalak. There's a little backstory of that taking place, of this underlying idea of the spies hearing this prophecy of Moses not going to be the one who lead them into the land. The men, Moses says, that God said to the, Adonai spoke to Moses, saying, send some men on your behalf to investigate the land of Canaan, which I am giving to the children of Israel. Each man you are to send will be a prince of the tribe of his fathers, a man from each tribe. Well, they say, some of the rabbis say, well, you need to read this with Deuteronomy to really get a clearer picture as well. So we go to Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy says, I said to you, you have come to the hill country of the Amorites, which Adonai your God is giving to us. See, Adonai your God has set the land before you. Go up and take possession of it, as Adonai your God of your fathers has promised you. Do not be afraid or discouraged. So now they've come out. They're sitting at the land. We're right here at Shalak. Moses is saying, go take the land. He says, then all of you came near to me and said, let us send men ahead of us to explore the land for us and bring back word about the way we should go and that the cities we will enter. So here Deuteronomy looks like it's giving us a different take. It's Moses is saying, they came to me asking to go scout the land. Rashi mentions that Moses went to discuss with God. And Numbers 13 is the response. But then God says, go send for yourself these men. It's like God was saying, I already told you that I promised you the land. Look at all the miracles that have taken place just to get you to this point. Exodus from Egypt, the plagues, the parting of the waters for you to walk across on dry land, battling the Amalekites, clothing and shoes that did not wear. You had manna to eat. You had water from the rock. You had everything you needed. I provided everything for you. And now you think I can't bring you into this land? You think you need to go scout it. But So, is it appropriate that we can call them children of Israel, just like us, for adults being adults, yet we are children, yet physically adults, but sometimes spiritually children? All of these miracles they're experiencing are to awaken their souls to the revelation of God. These journeys are to grow them stage by stage. It's like our kids. We provide everything we need for them. They have clothes. They have food. They have shelter. They have all the basics, right? They have everything they need. And yet, sometimes they still complain, right? You take your kid out. You have the best day ever. You go. You're going to go shopping, what have you. You're going to go take them see a movie. You're going to go to the park. You're going to play. They're like, this is the best day ever. You come home, and you put the juice in the wrong cup. I don't know if y'all ever had that happen. Or your kids do that. The tantrum that goes, or they weren't able to open the box of cereal there on their own. Like, you poured it for them. They explode. This is the worst day ever. Right? It's like God is, I've provided all of this for you. Right? How many times do we tell God, like, where's the water? Why aren't things going the way I planned, Lord? Are you even here? Does God always have to transcend the laws of nature for us to see him, to know that he is there, to prove he's there? I'm sure we've all experienced miracles, you know, in times in our lives where God has supernaturally shown up. But that won't be the case all the time. We need to move forward and walk in the trust that he has already shown us as his children. The trust that he says, I am here. So we go by the prophecy. We're hearing Moses won't lead them. Now they're worried about going in with Joshua, whom they aren't confident in. Is this truly the case? Where does Joshua first show up? You know, Joshua first comes up in Exodus 17. Because then the Amalekites came and they attacked Israel from behind. All right, so Israel just left Egypt. Now the Amalekites are coming and they attack them at their most vulnerable spot from the rear. Moses says, go out and choose men with you, Joshua, and fight the Amalekites, for tomorrow I'll stand on the hill with my staff in God's hand. And Joshua did just as Moses said. All right, he's up on the mountain. He's holding the staff. When his hands are up, they're winning. When he's getting tired, his hands drop down, they start to lose. Yet Aaron and Hur came along his side, sat him down on a rock, they each on one side, holding him up so that as he's lifting up, Joshua's overpowering the army. The Amalekite is the descendant of Esau. The gematria value, numerical value of Amalek is 240, the same as Sephek in Hebrew, which means doubt. Amalek's job is to cast doubt. Who else have we heard about the casting doubt in the garden, right? In Eve, with Eve, on did God really say? There's a book by, it's called The Concealed Light, that the Vine of David, FFOZ, puts out by Dr. Zvi Sadon. He says, the war of Joshua wages against Amalek. The war that he wages against Amalek happens on three planes. The war against Amalek of the heart, which is our evil inclination and our evil qualities that we have. The war against the spiritual Amalek, which is the Satan. And the war against the physical Amalek, which are descendants of Esau and Ishmael, and even the mixed multitude. What is our weakest area? What's our weakest area? Where does the enemy have a largest stronghold on us? Is it in this aspect of our mental, emotional health? Is it something physical? Is it something spiritual? We have to take account of these areas in our life and capture them and take hold of them and submit them to God, because he is the one who ultimately delivers us. Being a descendant in the line of Joseph, because Joshua is from the tribe of Ephraim, he's looked at as a Mashiach ben Yosef of this generation. The war between, so Mashiach ben Yosef, I will say Mashiach ben Yosef, you're not familiar with that concept. There is a Mashiach, two Messiahs, one who comes and who's here to deliver his people from sin, more of a spiritual type of deliverance. This is your Mashiach ben Yosef. Then you have Mashiach ben David. He's going to be the conquering king who comes in. The war between Yehoshua and Moses and Amalek is that of faith and trust and doubt. The main aspect of the Mashiach ben Yosef is the war with Amalek. Yeshua, he perfectly fulfills this role. Right? And he will be returning as Mashiach ben David. We eagerly await that time. The Midrash by a rabbi says, before God can destroy a nation, its spiritual representative must be defeated. God can certainly wipe out Amalek, but it is we who prevent God due to our sins. Romans 8 says, for those who live according to the flesh set their minds on the things of the flesh, but those who live according to the Spirit set their minds on the things of the Spirit. For the mindset of the flesh is death, but the mindset of the Spirit is life and shalom, peace. Right? When Yeshua sends them out to the nations, to the lost house of Israel, he tells them, when you go into the homes, if they do not have, you give them shalom. You send your shalom. If your shalom does not come back on you, then you leave. Right? It's like that aspect of the Spirit. You're feeling. He's having this sense of, are these people being receptive through the Spirit to what we're saying? The mindset of the flesh is hostile toward God, for it does not submit itself to the law of God, for it cannot. So those who are in the flesh cannot please God. If we live according to our fleshly desires, then of course the doubt is going to stay. The enemy has a stronghold in our life. Amalek is the evil inclination within us, and we constantly wage this war. Yet we're overcomers through the work of Yeshua. Yeshua conquered sin and Amalek, and he freed us from the grips of Amalek. Romans 8, 15, 16 says, for you did not receive a spirit of slavery to fall again into fear. Rather, you received the spirit of adoption by whom we cry, Abba, Father. And the Ruach himself, the Spirit himself, bears witness with our spirit that we are children of God. Yeshua freed us from the spirit of Amalek, from the spirit that sees everything as a deficiency, as something's wrong. God is not here. No, God is present. God gave us his spirit to sense this. God gave us a spirit to know throughout everything you have going on in your life, I am with you. So we go back to Aaron and Hur real quick. He's holding up his hands. The word hands there, or the word for steady, it says Moses, his hands were steady when Aaron and Hur were holding them up. The word steady means, is Hebrew there, is emunah. His hands were faithful and steady. Service of God can be hard. It's not meant to be done alone. This work is not meant to be, it's meant to be done with the community. Right? Sometimes we get tired. Sometimes we need help. We need friends. We need community to help out when needed. If you're going through something difficult, reach out to someone in the community. We're all here. We're all here to help each other, build each other up. This is what the believers do. We're not here to tear each other down, but carry each other's burdens. Hosea, son of Nun, this is his name throughout all the text of Torah previously. We see Joshua, right? We get to the point where here Moses is giving out the names. He's selecting the people who's going. You see here all the names from the different tribes. And we see that Hosea, son of Nun, is there from the tribe of Ephraim. Right? It says, and Moses called Hosea, the son of Nun, Joshua. So it's like he changed his name there. So, Nun means is a symbol of faithfulness. It's a standing for humility. As I don't have a graphic, so sorry. But I will draw it in the air for you. Okay, so there's a Nun. It comes out like this. Down like a vav and bent, right? So this is the Nun if it's in the sentence, not at the end. It's bent above and it's bent below. This is the concept visually of humility. It's a complete nullification of your will, becoming a vessel to channel God's blessing. Noon is the number 50, meaning the 50 gates. Sages say there's 50 gates of wisdom, this inner aspect of the Torah that we strive to get, that the Messiah reveals to us in our hearts. And Hosea, Joshua, would stay in the tent of meeting as after when Moses would leave. He would stay in the presence of God. He's soaking it up. Where else do we see these 50 days? We go from redemption to revelation, from Pesach to Shavuot. You count 49 days. 49 days of preparation. The 50th day is he revealed the Torah. The 50th level is one that's given by God. It's not one that we are working for. Aramaic also says that noon means fish, or it means fish in Aramaic. So interestingly, we get the fish, we get the idea of the Christianity and the Yeshua and the concept of fish as well here, and of course the fishermen, and there's other verses that go a lot into that. Okay, so let's go back to the prophecy. Moses says they won't lead them. Now we're worried about going out with Joshua. Are they confident? So Moses in him, in his leading, they should be. They just watched him take out all these Amalekites. He led them through war. Right? Are they lacking faith now? Are they lacking this ability to see clearly? So the men come and want to scout out the land. Moses selects Hosea. Here we see that Moses changes Hosea's name back to Joshua by adding what you add to that to Hosea is a Yud at the beginning of his name. In the Talmud it says, where does this Yud come from? They ask this question in Sanhedrin Tractate. It says, he came from Sarai when her name was changed to Sarah. So here we go back to Sarah. The Yud is taken from Sarah when she's given the hay, and the Yud is switched for a hay for her, and the Yud is then given to Hosea. And that's how you spell Joshua. You just add the Yud in front of the Hosea. When Moses changed his name, it revealed the name of the one who would complete the redemption and cause Israel to enter the land. Hosea means salvation, but Yehoshua means God is salvation. Moses is giving them the sign, saying, it's not me, it's not Joshua, it's God. It's God doing the work. Moses fully trusted Joshua. He wanted to send someone who's been by his side since leaving Egypt, and someone who would bring back an accurate report, his one true trusted disciple. All right, so he sends them, they go through the Negev. He gives them things to consider, right? He says, hey, let's go through, which sounds like a reasonable thing. If you're going to go, okay, well, let's do this. Let's look at it from a business perspective. Do they have all of these things that we're going to need once we're there? Right? Is the land strong or weak? Is it going to be easy for us to conquer? There are few or many. What kind of land are they living? Is it good or bad? What about the cities, right? So this is all the questions he's asking. They return after scouting for 40 days. They start out with acknowledging God's promises are true. They say, yes, the land is flowing with milk and honey. Yes, it's exactly how God said it would be. And then they say, but, negating the entire first of the half of the sentence. They spread Lashon Hara to the entire community, causing Amalek to rise, causing the doubt to rise in people. Like, well, you saw there's giants in there. Okay. No doubt, Abram saw giants. It says, I'm going to take that as a leap, because it says all those same clans were in the land. Even the Rephaim were in the land. The Rephaim are the descendants of the Nephilim as well. But God just promised them the land. God said, you are going to go in and take it. But they only see how they cannot conquer it. They have limiting beliefs. Moses said, go and see how it can be accomplished, not if it can be accomplished. They say, we seem like grasshoppers in our eyes. Right? They say, we seem like grasshoppers in our eyes. Sure, there's giants, The giants are there, but they're seeing how their perception, it's their perception that the verse is saying. We see ourselves like grasshoppers in front of in their eyes, in our eyes. They don't have the faith and belief and trust. God just, after everything God just did, I mean, he just split water and a massive sea for you to walk through. They can't do it. They're looking at it from their own perspective, from the materialistic side, from the physical side of things. Caleb stands up. Joshua's with him. They say, no, we can do it. Caleb had a different spirit within him. All right, he says Caleb had that belief. He had the belief that God is in control and we can do this. Joshua and Caleb are the only two who did not die after coming back from that report. All the other 10, they were struck down. Not only did the 10, it shows that their lack of trust in God, but also the lack of obedience. Not just faith, they didn't have the obedience to say, to go. God said, go do this, go take the land. Just a side note, which is, I thought was interesting. If you look at Ezekiel 37, when it's talking about dry bones, and it says the two sticks will come together, and the sticks are the house of Judah and the house of Joseph, but specifically the stick of Ephraim. They come together. They are the ones who bring, now it's these that are bringing the house and uniting the house together. Where are Joshua and Caleb from? Joshua's from the tribe of Ephraim. Caleb's from the tribe of Judah. I just thought that was an interesting little tidbit there. Not sure if there's anything with that, but I thought it was interesting nonetheless. Another perspective to look at is this. So, like I said, they had everything in the desert that they needed. They didn't have to ask for absolutely anything, right? All their basics were covered. They were living in this like semi, kind of quasi messianic type situation. Everything is preserved, right? Nothing is, it's kind of how when Messiah comes back, it's described that everything, you will have what you desire. But your desire will be that, of course, in service of God. They had everything they needed to serve God. Now they were just told, but now you're going to go work. You're going to go take the land. They're like, wait, I have to go and I have to start growing food? It's not just going to be given to me anymore? My food, my clothes are going to wear now. I'm going to have to sew and patch things. And apparently, Midrash says that they didn't even go to the restroom. I'm going to have to go dig holes outside the camp. Although, that is said in Torah, so I did say to go into the camp. I have to go outside, so I will take that one back. But rabbinic commentary mentions that people, says they were, when they're walking through the land, says these, the land is devouring its inhabitants, right, as they're walking through. But everywhere else, when it talks about disobedience, it says that God will, the land will spit the people out. It doesn't talk about the land devouring its people. Meaning, the land devouring the people, they say, meaning they will be consumed by work and material aspects of life now. They're not going to have time to be in God's presence, to study, and go through Torah and prayers. Surely God didn't bring me out of slavery, out of Egypt, to go to this promised land only to work again. But we're always meant to marry these two. We're not supposed to look at just something spiritual and physical as though they're opposites. It's the same. We are to reveal God's glory. Everything in the physical has a spiritual root to it. Everything, we're supposed to reveal God's glory through the physical. That's what the Torah is. That's what the mitzvot are. Every mitzvah we do in this earth reveals more and more of his glory to those around us. So the judgment comes on, right? They're now here 40 years. God says, you will be 40 years now wandering the desert until this entire generation dies off. 1 year for each day that you were scouting the land. What's significant about 40? So we have a lot of examples from Scripture about 40. Moses is on Mount Sinai for 40 days. Yeshua is in the desert for 40 days being tempted. Noah's flood, it rained for 40 days. They say a mikvah in halacha. A mikvah is to be 40 seahs of water to purify the person from their ritual impurities, corresponding to the 40 days of the floodwaters which rain down to purify the earth. Just if you wanted to know how much a seah is, there are different variations of that, but it's about 175 gallons of water. So, there you go. Trivial information there. The Talmud describes a fetus being formed. It takes 40 days. So I was looking into that. A fetus that goes from the embryonic stage to the fetal stage, it's within that 5 to 8 week range. So you have, and then they say the heartbeat starts around 6-ish weeks. So we're in this 40-day time period here. Gestational period for women, 40 weeks. Yeshua stayed after resurrection, 40 days. There's a preparation time for a transformative change. And that change happens, they say, is associated with 40. However, in this case, it went the opposite way for them. They weren't preparing for something good. They went 40 days for their unbelief, right? And then they were relegated to 40 years in the desert. Whereas in Yeshua's time, his own people of his time did not believe him. They did not accept him. And after his death, 40 years later, the temple fell. Interestingly enough, we have from entering Egypt to the redemption and witnessing God's manifest presence in their midst, the book of Exodus is 40 chapters long. We get to Matthew 10, Yeshua tells his 12, go out. He's instructing them. He gave them power and authority over unclean spirits to drive out every kind of disease and sickness. He says, but don't go to the Gentiles yet, nor to any Samaritan town, but go instead to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. And as you go, proclaim, the kingdom of heaven has come near. Heal the sick, raise the dead, cleanse those with Zarat, and drive out demons. Freely you receive, freely you give. Do not get gold or silver or copper for your money belts, or a bag for the journey, or two shirts, or sandals, or a walking stick. For the worker is entitled to his food. All of that seems like it's representing what was going on in the desert. Yeshua is telling them, don't take this, don't take that. You don't need any of this. You have what you need. You have everything you need. Now you're going to go do the work. Luke 9 talks about how they come back and they're eager to tell Yeshua everything that's happened. Right? They didn't come back with a bad report here. They were saying, look at how the demons are fleeing from us, right? They're casting out right and left. The Spirit is at work among us. The kingdom was at hand then. Hebrews 3 says, therefore, just as the Ruach HaKodesh says, today if you hear his voice and do not harden your hearts, as in the rebellion, on the day of testing in the wilderness, there your fathers put me to the test, though they saw my works for 40 years. Therefore, I was provoked by this generation, and I said, they will always go astray in their heart, and they have not known my ways. As I swore in my wrath, they shall not enter my rest. It looks like, right, the guys came back with a bad report, and this was the first time. That's a harsh judgment. No, they were always going away and astray in their hearts. They had many times that they complained bitterly about God and how, where is he at? Why isn't he providing? You never know when that time's going to be, right? What that cutoff's going to be. We never know how many times is the God going to be, as Lord Yeshua going to be standing at our hearts, knocking on the door. We never know when he's going to leave. The Song of Solomon has a story about the woman she's sleeping, and the husband and the prince, he comes to the door and he's knocking. She says, he's asking her to come. She says, I'm too sleepy. I can't get up right now. And she knocks. He's knocking more. She says, "Go. I'm too tired. I can't get up." And then finally she arouses herself, gets up, and goes to the door, and he's gone. That was the picture of God coming to you, coming to his children, knocking at the door. But we don't know how many knocks we're going to get. So when he comes, we hearken and we hear his voice. We go run and go after him. The good word is alacrity. Alacrity means run with quickness. Do something with speediness. When you hear and you have an opportunity to do a mitzvah, to seek God, you have a chance to spend time with him, do it. Do it quickly. We don't want to be, like he says, they shall not enter my rest. We don't want to hear that. We don't want to hear where Yeshua says, I never knew you. That we did all these things, I never knew you. That's a sobering statement. To know that we should be diligently walking out our life, walking out our salvation. We're going to have voices of the 10 spies coming up in us, and that's the Amalekite coming up. It's the doubt coming up. But we know the promise that God's given us. We know the promise that Yeshua will be returning. We know that we already have the down payment of the Spirit within us to overcome, because he has overcome. And so we trust in that, and we trust in him. Make time for connection with God. See him working through every area of your life. Every aspect of your life, God is there. Remember the goodness that he's done for you in the past, and trust what is in the future. And everything, give thanks, for he's a good father. I'm going to read one story, and then we'll be done. When Oswald Chambers and his wife were married, they agreed that they would never speak of what seemed to be lacking or complain about the scarcity of money. They felt it would be an offense against God to infer that he was inadequate to meet their needs or that he was insufficiently providing for them. They agreed only to speak well of everything that comes from God's hand. They did not even complain about the weather. While stationed at YMCA in the Egyptian desert during the First World War, they had to endure the brutal heat of the Egyptian desert sun. The diary Chambers left behind never complains about the heat, even in the summer. Instead, the daily entries comment on the inspiring sunrises, the remarkable blazing glory of the midday sun, the solemn quiet grandeur of the desert sunsets, the amazing quiet of the desert nights, and the awesome display of stars spread over the nighttime sky. Philippians 4 says, I have learned to be content in whatever circumstances I am. I know how to get along with humble means, and I also know how to live in prosperity. In any and every circumstance, I have learned the secret of being filled and going hungry, both having abundance and suffering. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. All right. That's all I got. Questions or comments? It's 11:30, so I think we're still good for a few minutes. Nope, all right. Okay. All right, we'll have Jared come up. He's going to give us the Rosh Kodesh teaching for today. Oh, who? Oh, Manny. Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't see the hand.
Go for it. Yes, You were mentioning towards the beginning about work and faith and versus works.
Yeah.
As I understand it, in the Hebrew language, the word for faith is emunah.
Yes.
Which in Hebrew, not in English, but in Hebrew, yeah, always has a works component. Otherwise, it's not faith. So that's something that often gets lost in English translation because it just says faith, but it's deeper in Hebrew.
Yeah, agreed. That's what James says, right? That's the verse in James that discusses that. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, Richard.
So it really impressed upon me when you talked about Aaron and her holding up Moshe's hands with the staff, right? And how kept his hands steady, and you said the word steady is emunah, which really struck me. As Aaron and her kept the hands of Moshe steady, faithful, so was community needed to help keep us faithful. In our study of Revelation, Jamie asked how we should prepare for the end. You had brought up the verse from 1 Peter 4. The end of all things is close at hand. Therefore, keep alert and self-controlled for the sake of your prayers. More than anything, keep earnestly loving each other because love covers many sins. Welcome one another into your homes without grumbling. As each one has received some spiritual gift, he should use it to serve others. And then in Hebrews 10, so prayer, love, community, and service is how we prepare, not with the reaction of fear. In Hebrews 10, let us keep paying attention to one another in order to spur one another, to spur each other onto love and good deeds, not neglecting our own congregational meetings as some have made practice of doing, but rather encouraging each other, and let us do this all the more as you see the day approaching. Again, community is necessary to strengthen our faith, our trusting loyalty. And then you have 1 Timothy 1. Holding faith and a good conscience. Holding faith and a good conscience. By rejecting this, some have made shipwreck of their faith. It might be the translation difference, but the whole point is the adage of two sticks is stronger than one, and a bundle of three is even stronger. It is a trick of the enemy. Communities will hurt each other, right? We will make mistakes. That's us. And people will leave community because of these things, but that is a trick of the enemy. Yeah. Because if he can isolate you, he can destroy you.
Yeah.
But if you keep within the bounds of community, and as a community, we work through the pain with love. We are protecting our faith in God.
Yeah. Amen. Amen. Absolutely. Absolutely. All right. Oh, Ben in the back. All right, last one.
Great job, Omid. As you were sitting there speaking, one of the things that's most important, I think, that comes out of this parsha is just the words that we use and how they can affect other people, right? I know in Psalm 64 specifically, it's a prayer about guarding, you know, the heart and stuff from those vicious words of lack of trust, of anger, of hurt. And I think it's just one of those things from what you're speaking of today, how so important it is that we just align with the Lord and in community to just speak life to each other, right? Because ultimately, you know, when Caleb was trying to speak to the children of Israel, and so was Joshua, they were trying to speak life where the other 10 didn't. So it's just super important that as a community, you know, we hold on to those things. And
yeah. You know,
Psalm 64 is just a great verse to just, for this parsha, to just sit there and think about that and meditate on that.
Amen, amen. Yeah, and they wanted to stone them giving the good report. They're like, stone these guys. It says violently they wanted to stone them, their own community. Yeah.
Thank you for joining us. If you enjoyed this message, please consider sharing it with a friend or family member and help us out by giving a review on iTunes or other podcast platform. Check out our website at walkingemmausroad.org for additional teachings and information about visiting Emmaus Road in Kingwood, Texas.